Well, hi, everyone. I'm so glad you're joining us this week in week three of our teaching series called Soul Care, where we've been exploring some ancient spiritual practices and asking what would it look like to arrange our lives in a way that our souls were being nurtured into full vibrancy. And not just for our own sake, but so that the fruit of the Spirit would be manifest in our lives for the benefit of everyone that we come in contact with. And so last week we talked about the practice of solitude. And today we're going to explore silence as a soul care life discipline. And I want to address something today. I know some of you are thinking, you know, hey, Pastor, it seems like you're talking us through like, you know, monk training school. And I'm not a monk, you know, I have a normal life with a job and hobbies and kids and a Traeger grill and mortgage payments. Things like silence and solitude and these spiritual practices, they might work for religious fanatics like yourself, but I'm just a normal dude. And so I'm not sure this is for me. So I want to address that mindset. You know, we established in week one that Jesus was a rabbi, and every rabbi had what was called a yoke, which was a farming word, but it was also used for the set of teachings that rabbi would offer his students. It was a picture of how the rabbi was connected to his students as they walked through life together, shouldering the weight of life with one another. And Jesus' yoke was called easy and his burden light, and it's because it came with the promise of doing life with Jesus. And so here's what I want you to see. When Jesus offers a life of faith, it isn't to the religious elite. It's to the average Joe. You see, Christianity has always been about the faith of ordinary people. Let me illustrate. Okay, so Jesus was a rabbi. Not just anybody would walk around and call himself a rabbi. It was one of the highest professions, and it came with rigid standards and intense accountability. And for a young boy growing up in Israel, to be a rabbi was the greatest, kind of most prestigious thing that could happen to you. Because Israel's passion was the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. That's what distinguished them as a people. And so every little boy in Israel would enter into a religious education program from the time that they were six, kind of like our elementary school. And their version of religious elementary school was called Bet Sefer, the house of the book. So between the ages of 6 and 10, every little boy would go to the school of a specific rabbi or teacher and would literally sit at his feet. And from dawn until afternoon, they would memorize the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And they would chant the Torah. Sometimes the rabbi would put a little honey on the tongues of those little kids because he wanted them to associate God's word with the most delicious, wonderful thing that they could imagine. Your word is like honey on my lips. And so those little children would read and they would hear and they would study and they would memorize Torah. And by about the age of 10, they would kind of sort themselves out. Most of them would be done with school and they'd go back home and they'd learn the family trade. They'd become a fisherman or a carpenter, a tradesman of some kind. But there would be some high-achieving students who showed a particular affinity for the Torah. They had a special gift. They were really bright, they were really spiritual, and they loved spiritual things. And those students received the high honor of being accepted to the next level of school, the Bet Talmud, the house of learning. And so from the ages of 10 to 14, like our middle school years, Bet Talmud was the best of the best. Now that they had the first five books of the Old Testament memorized, they would begin work on memorizing the rest of the Old Testament, memorizing it word for word. But not just for memorization, their rabbis would now be asking them questions of understanding, like what work is permitted on the Sabbath, and how do you honor your father and mother? And they would keep memorizing, and these young boys, day after day, year after year, the Torah. By the age of 14, the best of the best of Bet Talmud would have the Bible memorized from Genesis to Malachi. And the best from this group would go on in their religious studies. They would find a rabbi that they admired and they would ask, you know, could I please be one of your disciples? Could I be a follower? Could I be an apprentice? This is kind of like our college application process. You put your application out there and you hope that they choose you. And so a rabbi would receive the application and they would give them a test. And if the student passed the test, the rabbi would accept them as one of his disciples. This level was called Bet Midrash, the house of study. Now, let me be clear. Rabbis never, ever went around recruiting students. That would be beneath their dignity. Students came to them and they begged them, can I please be a disciple of yours? I beg of you. And the rabbi would test them. You know, do they know the Torah? Have they memorized the whole thing? Are they able to interpret it rightly? And do they know what different rabbis have said about different interpretations over the century? Where do they land on their interpretation? And if the kid was good enough, the rabbi would say yes, but usually not. Usually the rabbi would say no. So go home, get married, raise a family, love God, lead a good and godly life, get probably a more professional job in society, but go do that and God bless you, but no, you can't be one of my disciples. You just don't make the grade. Just the best of the best made it that far to be an actual disciple of a rabbi. In our day, it's kind of like the equivalent of making it to Princeton or Harvard. Students would, you know, leave everything for this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And the goal of a disciple at this stage was not just to learn, it was to be exactly like the rabbi. Jesus described it this way. He said, "No disciple is above his master, his rabbi. But every disciple, when fully trained, will be like his master, his rabbi." Now, here's my point. Here's the reason I wanted to paint this whole context for you. What I just described was the path for a career minister, rabbi. That was the pastors and the missionaries and the priests and the monks. They went through the whole process, reading, learning, memorizing, applying, and then begging to be accepted as a disciple of a rabbi. Now, Jesus was a rabbi, but Jesus was different. Jesus walks along, remember, and he begins finding guys from all walks of life. And he approaches them and he says, "Follow me." And that invitation, "Follow me," carries with it the expectation of a rabbi and his disciples that they will follow him everywhere, that they will learn everything he has to teach them and ultimately learn not just his words, but they would want to imitate his every move. But watch this. Do you remember where he finds his first disciples? Do you remember what they were doing? They were fishing. They were part of a family fishing business. Remember that they came running out of the water to the point it sounds like they practically left their fishing boat sailing unmanned out into the sea and their dad holding the nets. What does that tell us? Well, we said only the best of the best would get accepted into a rabbi school. And so the fact that they're fishing means that they already flunked out long ago. Like probably when they were 10 years old, they didn't make the cut. They'd given up on that dream to be a disciple of any rabbi long ago. And remember also, in Jesus' day, rabbis never recruited their disciples. It was beneath them. Prospective disciples only came to the rabbi, but here comes Jesus, this rabbi with an invitation. It would have been like getting rejected from Harvard and then a few years later getting a letter that says, "Never mind, we found a spot for you. Will you come?" But this wasn't just any rabbi. They could tell from the start, this was a rabbi with power. This was a rabbi with healing in his wings. This was a rabbi who, when he talks about God, it makes hearts melt. That this rabbi comes to these rabbi school dropouts, these rejects, and he says, "You and you and you and you, come with me, follow me. You're gonna be my disciples. Follow me, take my life as your life. Follow my lifestyle, follow my ways, follow my teachings. Take my yoke upon you, and I'll show you how to navigate life in a way that will bring meaning and purpose and fulfillment and mission. And it's ultimately going to make your life count." And Jesus made this offer not to the super spiritual people, but to the ordinary ones like you and me. And so as we talk about these practices, I would ask you, don't be dismissive. Don't say, you know, "That's for someone else. That's for the religious people." No, Jesus offers this to you. And so today, our soul care practice is silence. And I'm going to introduce it, and then we're going to try it together. But here's my big idea today. Quiet spiritual listening will revive your soul. Do you know what voice you need to be the loudest in your life? It's God's voice. And here's the thing. God doesn't have a speaking problem. His children have a listening problem. God is not silent. God is not withdrawn and uncommunicative. Like one of the greatest benefits of the Christian life is the fact that God actively communicates to us. We all know that a key foundation for any relationship is communication. Well, the same is true in your relationship with God. And listen, it's really important that you learn how to hear God's voice so that you can grow in your relationship and you can deepen your walk with Him and that your soul can be cared for. And so instead of going through life blindly, you can walk with confidence with the wisdom of God to guide and protect you. The good news is that God is speaking. It's never God who's not speaking. It's us who are not hearing. I love this verse in Ecclesiastes 5, 1 and 2. It says, "To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools." Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. So many of us whose mouths are always blabbering with words and whose fingers are always typing social media posts, we're offering the sacrifice of fools, meaningless words when we should be silent. I think one of the reasons we find it so hard to be silent is because it makes us feel helpless. Like we're used to controlling and managing our lives and other people with our words, and that without them we feel powerless. Like if we're silent, who's going to take control? And that's just the point, isn't it? We truly do need God to be in control. But there's another reason I think we find it so hard to practice silence, and it's because our lives are filled with noise and distractions all around us. Ronald Rollheiser says this. He says, we are distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion. We have so much noise. I mean, there's external noise and there's internal noise, like to the point that the clutter and the voices that will fill our minds, it forces us to live like mental hoarders. The external noise is made up of the voices that we allow to occupy space in our heads. It's the worldviews that we invite in through our music, through our cable news, through our podcasts. It comes in through which social media influencers we follow, the latest Netflix series, even the nagging voice of a family member or a college professor or a bully from junior high that just won't seem to leave us. But the gravitational pull of outside voices, it has become like second nature to us. Where does the urge come from? To reach for the knob when you get in the car, to flip on the TV when you walk in the house, to listen to a podcast during your workout, or to have Snapchat open while you're reading a book. Maybe we're afraid of a state of non-distraction, or maybe we're using the external voices to drown out the internal voices of our own minds. Internal voices like replaying the lousy conversation you had with your spouse, or your mind wandering to lustful thoughts or fantasies of power or fame or beauty. Maybe it's the voice of shame reminding you what a failure you are all the time, or thoughts of revenge or anxious thoughts of worry or obsessing over hypothetical scenarios that'll probably never happen, or dreaming of the perfect life that always seems just out of reach. Sometimes I wonder if we crank up the volume just to drown out our inner voices. And so yeah, silence can be scary. But what is this practice of silence? Well, silence, and we'll define it this way, it's simply the act of spiritual listening. It's when you turn the volume down on both the external and internal voices, and then you listen for the voice of God. Silence, you see, is not just not talking. To simply stop talking without a heart that's listening to God is not this kind of silence. I like how the folks at Renovare describe it. They say silence is closing off our souls from sounds, whether noise, music, or words, so that we may better still the inner chatter and clatter of our noisy hearts and be increasingly attentive to God. Well, our rabbi Jesus showed us the way here too. He shows us that while silence can be scary and it can make us feel helpless, it can also be the source of our greatest strength. John Mark Comer brings some insight into this account of Jesus in the desert, and I just want to take you there for a moment. It's over in Matthew chapter 4. Matthew 4, it happens right after Jesus' baptism, as he's getting ready to launch his public ministry. Matthew 4, 1 says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry, and the tempter came to him." Then down in verse 10, "Then Jesus said to him, 'Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.' And then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and were ministering to him." So verse 1 says that Jesus went to the wilderness. And this word wilderness is actually the word eremos. And it's been translated a bunch of different ways: desert or deserted place or desolate place or solitary place. Maybe the most literal translation, it just means the quiet place. Appropriate for our discussion of silence today, the quiet place. Now, I've always read this account of the temptation of Jesus, and I thought, how crafty of Satan. Like, Jesus was just ready in the last chapter to take the world by storm. He'd been baptized, his ministry had just been inaugurated, and then immediately, it says he was led into the wilderness, into the eremos. And he was hungry, and he was alone, and he was silent. There was nobody with him, and that's when the tempter came to him, in the quiet place. And I always thought the devil was so clever by coming to Jesus just at his weakest moment, at his worst, at his most vulnerable. But I had it completely backwards. The desert, the quiet place, was actually Jesus' place of strength. The devil came to him at the height of his spiritual power. You see, Satan had no chance because the showdown happened in the quiet place. And as we saw last week, it seems like the busier Jesus got, the more he returned to the Eremos. In fact, Luke 5:16 emphasizes that Jesus often, that he frequently, it says Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. He returned again and again to the Eremos, to the quiet place. That's where he was the strongest. And I think you and I too can find strength and courage and spiritual power in the quiet place. Let me ask you, do you have a quiet place? Do you have a place where you can stop talking and just listen? A place where the voice of God is louder than all the other voices, including your own. A place from which you can stand strong against all of the enemy's advances in your life. One of the ancient practices that Jesus showed us is the practice of silence, the quiet place. Let me give you some practical ideas about this before we practice it ourselves today. Here's some tips for practicing the discipline of silence in 2022. How about this? Wake up just 20 minutes before the rest of your family does. Or if you're a night owl, stay up a little longer than everyone else. Turn off the noise and listen for the voice of God. Find your chair. How about this? Treat your bath or your shower like a fortress of silence. Like it's probably the closest most of us will get to a monastic cell each day. Or do your daily run or your workout in silence. And I know your music gets you pumped up and it makes you, you know, your exertions easier, but you'll be shocked by the number of insights that come to you when you exercise in silence. Or how about this? Drive in silence. Your car is a mobile and vastly underutilized sanctuary. You can achieve complete solitude in silence on every solo drive, whether you're going to work or to the store to pick up your kids. How about take scheduled breaks from all screens? Limit the noise and input by designating a few nights a week where phones go into a basket during dinner time, or give your phone a bedtime that's an hour or two before yours. Put it to sleep so you're not tempted. Or how about this? Do a silence retreat. Even if it's just a few hours, it could be a whole weekend, maybe once per year, where you leave the noise behind, including TV and devices, and you just get alone with God. You know, over the last 10 years or so, I've tried to build in some regular time at a cabin in the woods at a local monastery to practice silence and solitude. A couple of years ago, I arrived at the monastery. I was hiking up through the woods to my cabin, lugging my bags and my sleeping gear, and there was this big old tree along the path. It just struck me in that moment as so beautiful. Now, I'm not a huge nature guy, so this really isn't my normal spiritual love language, but in that moment, it captured me. And so I sat down under that tree. And no joke, no exaggeration, about 20 minutes later, I felt my soul waking back up. I wasn't praying. I wasn't reading my Bible. I wasn't doing anything particularly spiritual. I was just silent, and I was open to the idea that God could speak. And he began to refresh and revitalize my soul. Now, your question may be, you know, once you've carved out a little pocket of solitude and silence, what do you do during that time? Well, it's a time you can fill with other spiritual practices, reflection, meditation, reading of the scriptures, study, prayer, fasting, journaling, self-examination. It's a great time, for example, to consider decisions that lie before you, to take inventory of your life and your relationships. You know, it's funny to me how the whole world has seemed to catch on to this. There's a business book out right now called White Space, and it talks about these pauses. Or the buzzword right now is mindfulness, which is just the secular version of silence and solitude. And the problem is the world is just missing out on the best part, that the presence of God. So remember, the goal of silence isn't just the absence of noise. It's attentiveness to the voice of God. Some months back, I wrote an ebook called A Beginner's Guide to Hearing God's Voice. It has tons of ideas in there. You can still go grab a free copy over at whoisgrace.com/God's Voice. But guys, this isn't an introvert or extrovert thing. This is an ancient spiritual practice that has marked followers of Jesus from the very beginning. And silence itself is an act of faith. It's posturing us to believe that God will make himself known in some way. And so I'm praying for greater faith, for you, for me, for our church, for the Holy Spirit to speak to the people of grace as we seek him in silence. Your host is going to come now and walk us through a soul care workshop moment as we practice silence. I love you guys.